This recording is a production of Anabaptist Financial. More recordings are available on our website at www.afweb.org under the Resources menu or by calling 800-653-9817. This presentation was recorded at a Deacon and Trustee seminar held on June 23, 2026 in Memphis, Missouri.
This room is full of men that have been ordained to carry weight. Men and couples that God has called into the kingdom to be weight carriers. You help bury the dead. You visit the sick. You mediate conflict. And you help guard the soul of the congregation. I'm fully aware that in this large of a group and representing different types of conservative Anabaptist congregations, the role of a deacon in your particular congregation might not be exactly the same as the person sitting beside you. However, overall, we go to the scriptures to look for our direction of what it means to be a deacon. I've been very blessed to be able to come to these events, been to most of them since they started, and always go back home very inspired and blessed to dig in deeper and serve our local community. My wife and I were ordained 11 years ago, serve in Osceola Christian Fellowship there in Texas, just south of Dallas-Fort Worth. I also am very privileged to get to work with many different communities through my work with ASAL across 10 different countries in this aspect of finances. And you know that you can't get real close to a man's pocketbook, a family's pocketbook, or a congregation's pocketbook without being very close to every other aspect of that person or that family or that community. Understanding that, I would like to look at teaching financial responsibility. If you open your booklet to page 8, the title here is Teaching Financial Responsibility. When this title was suggested, I kept the title the same, although it's not the title I wanted, and I thought maybe keeping the title the same and then having you cross out the two words that I want to cross out and change for something else will actually help you remember this. I would like for you to cross out the word teaching and write above it discipleship. Disciple financial responsibility. Then I would like for you to cross out the word responsibility and write right underneath it faithfulness. Discipling financial faithfulness is a title that I preferred. Responsibility is a very important word, and we want to teach responsibility, but responsibility can be used many different ways. When I think of this subject, I'm thinking about the next generation, and most of you are probably also thinking of the next generation. Now, some of you might be young enough, you're mostly thinking about your own generation when we talk about the next generation. I'm probably kind of in the middle there. I'm 52 years old. And as we think about preparing the next generation, which is what this topic is, I want to be very clear, you can't teach, you can't disciple what you don't have. And that's why I like the word discipleship. If you are concerned about the next generation, then you're most certainly going to pay much attention to what's in your own heart and how you're relating to this subject. Why do I like the word faithfulness more than responsibility? This session is to teach the next generation and to help us teach the next generation how to become more like Jesus, not more like Elon Musk. If you came to this session because you're impressed with trillionaires and you wanted to see if you could get a little closer to that, and you're wanting to learn financial, and the word that pulled you in here was financial, and you want to learn how to make more money so that you can pursue your selfish dreams, then this session is going to be very boring for you. You might as well go back and take a nap. My burden and my heart this morning is that collectively we can understand and see more of the heart of Jesus as it pertains to this subject. Thus, disciple financial faithfulness is what I care the most about. In the introduction that the brother gave, he said that I care deeply about the triple bottom line, and I do. And that is kingdom impact, social impact, and financial impact. I'd like for you to write that right beside financial, go /social, and then /kingdom. I think it's very pertinent that when we look at this word financial, that we understand that we're talking about faithfulness, we're talking about stewardship, that ties all three of those together. If you expected this session to be only about how do I teach the next generation debits and credits, then you're at the wrong session. If you expected it to be how to only have some practicals, then you're at the wrong session. Those three go together. So when I say financial, I always mean, I'm not always going to use those words, but when I say financial, I'm always talking about the triple bottom line. Because your finances should have a kingdom impact, and those are tied together in the foundation of love. Thank you to the brother that had the previous session. I felt like he laid an incredible foundation to what we have to share today. So, how can we teach the next generation to manage the resources wisely and practice God-honoring stewardship? Stewardship there, in your next slide, underline that word because I really, really care about that word, stewardship. Now I want to bring a little side note in here because I don't want to just tell you what I believe you should do and some of the things we should do. And by the way, I'm here not as an exhaustive teacher on the subject, by no means. I'm here as a fellow student with you to learn more about this because I care about this. And I think that you're here because you care about this as well. At the minimum, what I would love to do is to whet your appetite for you to go back home and dig into this deeper and to create more conversations around this. And maybe, just maybe, I can give you some practical tools that you can do that in an effective way. So not only do we want to talk about some things that we should do, I want to bring into here and weave it throughout the entire rest of this session of some of the things that we should not do. And I'm going to call that the core tension. The core tension is that our primary go-to to address this situation historically as a people group is behavior modification. And I don't want to get too complex here with words, but I want you to think carefully about what these words mean. Our tendency is to go tell the next generations how to adjust their behaviors so they don't make the mistakes that we don't want them to make. Let me tell you, behavior modification does not work. It has its place with little children. But when we're talking about something as weighty as this, to prepare the next generation to steward and to be faithful in this, it's going to take much more than behavior modification. What is behavior modification? Behavior modification says if we give the people the right rules, the right consequences, and the right incentives, they will behave correctly. And unfortunately, that's kind of the go-to in most of the financial training and in a lot of the education world. But we know different. Why do we know different? Because we have the Sermon on the Mount. We have Deuteronomy 6:1-7. And we have the Great Commission. We know as conservative Anabaptists, and it's something that we care about very deeply, that the internal and the external must be integrated. We know that a changed life flows from a changed heart. Brothers and sisters, if we care about this, we're going to pay attention to the heart. And we're going to make sure that this burden is inside of the next generation, not just a list of behaviors of what they should do. Let me read to you some very special verses and kind of some foundational verses to this from Deuteronomy 6. Now, these are the commandments, the statutes, and the judgments which the Lord your God commanded to teach you, that he might do them in the land whither ye possess it. This was some very clear words that God was giving his people before they went in to possess the land of Canaan. That thou mightest fear the Lord thy God to keep all his statutes and his commandments, which I command thee, thou and thy son's son, the next generations, thy son and thy son's sons, all the days of thy life, and that thy days may be prolonged. Hear therefore, O Israel, observe to do it, that it may be well with thee, and that ye may increase mightily, as the Lord God of thy fathers have promised thee, in the land that floweth with milk and honey. Hear, O Israel, the Lord our God is one Lord, and thou shalt love the Lord thy God with all thine heart, and with all thy soul, and with all thy might. And these words which I command thee this day shall be in thine heart. And thou shalt teach them diligently unto thy children, and shalt talk of them when thou sittest by the way, and when thou layest down, and when thou risest up. Are we doing this? That is so clear. So clear, and it applies to this subject. What are we doing with this? We have the Great Commission that says, go, make disciples, and baptize. Do we understand how this subject all comes together? Or do we have our Monday through Friday job, and then everything else, our Sunday is separate, and the other day that we behave, by the way, is when we come to the deacon seminar, because we know what they expect there. Or is our heart pure? And do our actions throughout, when we're sitting at dinner with our family, are we talking about these things? Are we being practical? We have the responsibility to teach sound decisions that reflect biblical values and long-term stability. The Bible is the source of truth, the standard of truth, for us in this. I have broken this out into two parts. Part one, the framework, why and how we teach. And part two, the practicals, what we teach and the tools. So hopefully you can leave this place with some tools and some practicals. It's going to be high level because you can only do so much in 45 minutes. Hopefully I can whet your appetite to dig in some of these tools. And I have tried to simplify this as I teach across many, many different communities, across 10 countries. And I see all these different needs, different communities, and all these things that come up. One of the things that, on the one hand, weighs me down, but on the other hand, is incredibly refreshing, you could guess it, our problems are all the same. I haven't really found a new set of problems in a new country. I thought, surely, once I get as far south as Argentina, their problems can't be the same as what we have in Texas or as what you have in Missouri. Guess what? I was wrong. Because most of the challenges we face is a human challenge. It's not a geography challenge. Now, there's nuances, I get that. But teaching the practicals, that's where you would like to go right now. But before I teach the practicals, I want to come back and put a little bit of a framework in place for you. I have found that if you understand the framework, you will understand better how to use the tools and when to use the tools. Why we teach the way we teach. The first thing, and I only have four points to the framework here. The rebirthing imperative, the five steps of discipleship, vision, mission, purpose, and core values. And then boundaries, the architecture of belonging. Let's look at rebirthing. The most powerful classroom is not the school. However, I care deeply about education, so let me hasten to say this, that the work that you're doing as deacons should most certainly be building on what you've already collectively been doing in the classroom since the child has been, since first grade. And should be building on what families have been doing in the community. If the families band together and care about this, and parents are teaching their children like we saw there in Deuteronomy, and then this is a live subject in the school, ask yourself this question: how much of this teaching are you doing in school? If not, there's a lot more that you could do. Maybe there's not a curriculum, but your teachers in school can weave this in at a thousand different places through the school, the time that the child spends in school. Now you're dealing with the next generation, the young people and the newly marrieds and those that are, you know, taking on financial obligations and working in, you're building, hopefully you're building on what the foundation that was laid there. Let me tell you, if you're not, it is really, really hard to start this subject with our people at the age of 16, 17, 18, and 19, if they don't already have that foundation. The best place to teach what I'm talking about here is a home, a farm, and a business. Creation is God's model. Creation is God's model. Every living system reproduces after its own kind by design. I want you to think about the importance of rebirthing. Rebirthing transfers life, values, and identity, not just information. When you're teaching this subject, make sure that you're not just imparting information, that you're actually rebirthing, building this. You're planting the seed, you're nurturing, you're watering, and then praying that God give the increase. The crisis that we have is that we have replaced rebirthing with behavior modification. Train up a child in the way he should go, and when he is old, he will not depart from it. Proverbs 22:6. How do we do this? You might be saying, well, this sounds idealistic. I kind of like what this sounds like, but how do we do this? I present to you a model, which I call the five steps of discipleship, that I think are incredibly critical for you to get this. So while this is part of the framework, this really starts giving you a tangible way to start using the tools. The first step of discipleship is tell. Communicate the what and the why. Vision pulls people forward. Show. Step two is show. Live it in front of them. Your business and your budgets or curriculum, involve them in it. Three is observe. Let them practice under oversight. Safe failure is essential. Four, analyze. Debrief together. Analyze builds wisdom. Analysis builds wisdom, not just skills. And lastly, adjust. Course correct together. This is where mentorship becomes culture. You know, our tendency, maybe I should say my tendency. This is a confession. My tendency is to do this. I do number one, I tell, and then I adjust. A number of years ago, I had a very practical example of this. My oldest son was, I forget, probably around 9 or 10, and he's heard me say this in speeches ever since he was in diapers. So he knew the language here. I come home one day, and I had given him very clear instructions to get the lawn mowed and to mow it well. And I used plenty of words to describe, and so I told. I did step number one. When I come home that evening, I called him out and I said, "Son, this is not done correctly." Now, for this to be meaningful, you need to know this about my son. He's not as aggressive as I am. He's wired more like my wife. And so he had never bowed out his chest at me before. And so he's just a very tame young man. Well, this time, I was in the garage there, and he just goes like this, "Dad, I'm done with this. I can't have it no more." And I get, that shocked me. I never saw that behavior before. And I said, "Son, what are you talking about? What's going on?" He's like, "You don't practice what you preach." I'm like, "Oh, brother, I'm in trouble." I'm like, "What are you talking about? We're talking about the yard. We're not talking about preaching here." He says, "Dad, you know how you go around telling everybody about the five steps of discipleship?" He's like, "Why don't you do that with your own family?" Guilty as charged. Guilty as charged. I said, "Son, I'm so sorry. You know, I had never showed him. Yeah, maybe I showed him how to start the zero turn. Maybe I showed him how to start the weed eater. And I presume that he'd seen me enough that he just, you know, it just rubbed off on him. He just got it. But I never discipled him." I said, "Son, get your boots on." Thankfully, right then we had two mowers. I took him out there and I said, "Let me start with pail again. Here's how you mow a yard. The first thing you do is, obviously, once you got your equipment ready, you cut it in. Then you true it up. And then you inspect it, make sure that you didn't miss anything. Then you put the finishing touches on it. And you know you're not finished then, because then you put the mowers away. Oh, and let me tell you how you put the mowers away. You make sure that you wash them off, they're nice and clean, and you store them. There's no grass on the decks and what making it rot. You do this very carefully. But now you do go through the exact same process in weed eating." And I proceeded to do that with him. You know, to this day, he cares about lawns like I know he never would have. I never had to come back home. I had to do that, by the way, for 2 or 3 weeks. It was at a time of the year where the grass was mowing very quickly, so I got to do that in 2 or 3 weeks several times. I never again, he has the love of nice yards, and I never had to tell him again. That's discipleship. This is how practical it gets. This does not come from some kind of a Harvard textbook. This comes straight from the scriptures. For years, I wanted to know, how was it possible? How did Jesus grow the largest organization, not to be fair, organism, the church? It has lasted over 2,000 years, and he did this with only 12 cantankerous men in 3 short years. You talk about a leadership challenge, and you see, this mattered to me, because by then I was traveling to all these different countries and trying to do leadership development, and I was still young. This was over 20 years ago. And I'm like, what do I know about it? And I'm like, if I want to learn about leadership, I must go to the Word of God and think, how did Jesus do this? In wrestling and wrestling with that question, I found the answer in one word: discipleship. It starts on the Sermon on the Mount and a few other places. It says, and Jesus sat down with his disciples and he told them. And then later it says, he went out. And I had never noticed this verse before. And it says, Jesus went from city to city. I'd noticed that. Here's the part I didn't notice. And the disciples were with him. He was showing them, hands-on, how you do this. And then later it says, he sent them out by 2 by 2. Another time he sent them 7 by 7. And then when they came back, you know, he analyzed. Of course, Jesus was Jesus. He was analyzing what they were doing out there while they were doing it. And when they came back, what did the disciples say? Someone tell me. Even the devils are subject to us. Now, I don't know how that sounds to you, but for a conservative Anabaptist, to be able to say that's pretty big stuff. Take the moment of seriousness with me here. But what did Jesus respond? Rejoice not. Somebody finish that. Rejoice not that the devils are listening to you and obey you, but rejoice that your names are written in heaven. Brothers and sisters, if you want to teach the next generation, you're going to have your own identity right. Identity matters. We'll look at that more in just a bit. Jesus adjusted them with some very strong words. If you're not adjusting, you're not discipling. Discipling to what? Discipling in a vacuum has very little meaning. When you're discipling, there needs to be vision, the future declared outcome. Where are you going? Mission, how are you going to get there? Purpose, why are you doing that? Values, what are the guardrails that you're going to stand between while you're on your way? Vision, an example, my own personal vision, sustainable kingdom communities. An example of mission is building sustainable kingdom communities one business at a time. Purpose statement, we steward resources because they belong to God. Remember this, purpose transforms obligation into calling. If you're trying to train and teach the next generation without that calling, and I wish I could park here and talk to you for the next 20 minutes about calling, because I care deeply about calling. I'm just going to put something out there that'll maybe whet your appetite and ask a question. What does calling have to do with the thorn in the flesh? Apostle Paul had a thorn in the flesh, and there's a lot of commentators that think different things of maybe what it was and what it wasn't. I think, contrary to most commentators, and I'm not an authority on scripture interpretation by no means, I'm not a theologian, but as I study the scriptures, I think Paul's thorn in the flesh was that the Gentiles would come to the kingdom. And that's what he gave his life to. Your thorn in the flesh, what is your thorn in the flesh? It's that deepest thing for you, your calling. I can almost with certainty say this, your calling is directly connected to the deepest pain that you've ever experienced. Love to say a lot more about that. Don't have time, that's not my subject. Values, it's the guardrails, the commitments that define what we will do and what we will not do on the way to the vision. Where there is no vision, the people perish. Proverbs 29:18. Boundaries. Flip the page. The architecture of belonging. One of the deepest needs of the human heart is the need to belong. Think about that. One of the deepest needs of the human heart is the need to belong. The paradox is, without boundaries, there is no belonging. Boundaries defines the inside, and we could say the outside. No boundaries, no belonging. In your congregation, in our congregations as Conservative Anabaptists, we heard it say in one of the previous speakers, he said, it's just a concern. It seems like we lose the appreciation for our traditions and for our rules and for, now we just got done saying it's not all about the rules. That is correct. But if you start taking away those boundaries, you start taking away the belonging. People should know if they're in or if they're out. No belonging, no boundaries, no belonging. Financial boundaries are not restrictions. They are invitations to trust. There's a number of Anabaptist financial folks here today, and I serve on Anabaptist Savings Loans International. As we work with other people's money, and we work with both the investor and the borrower, if all the AF representatives would come up here and stand up here and say, we've decided as of today we're going to get rid of all boundaries of how we work with the money in AF, would you invest? I see a lot of heads shaking. No. Financial boundaries are not restrictions. They are invitations to trust. Anabaptist community accountability is not control, its covenant.
Wow.
I wish I could park here and talk to you a while about that. I can't. I would like to inspire you to dig into the word covenant versus control. Practical boundaries, spending limits, debt ceilings, generosity commitments, accountability, relationships. Part two, getting into the practicals. What we actually teach and how. Number one is stewardship. This session is not about stewardship, so I expect when I say stewardship, you know what we mean by stewardship. Bring that into this, bring that concept, this foundational concept into this study. Identifying talents, developing skills to execute. The financial literacy ladder, four distinct disciplines. So let's look at this. Stewardship, the foundational concept. Before you can teach financial mechanisms, you must establish the theology. Going back to Deuteronomy, you have to put it in their hearts. If they don't understand the vision and the mission and the core values and the purpose statement, they don't understand the why and it's not in their hearts, we're back to this problem of behavior modification. And if behavior modification is your primary tool that you're using to pass it on to the next generation, I can tell you with 100% certainty, it's not going to work. Stewardship is the management of someone else's resources on their behalf. We are managers, not owners. Every financial decision is a stewardship decision. Budget are stewardship plans. Debt, think about this. Debt is borrowed stewardship, borrowed against future faithfulness. The earth is the Lord's and everything in it, Psalms 24:1. What about identifying talents and developing skills? We're more familiar with this whole thing of stewardship. In AF, we talk about a lot about stewardship resources, and we've been hearing a lot about stewardship in the last number of years. What about this thing? And I'm talking to a room full of weight carriers, of deacons, trustees, ministers, those of us that have been called to have the burden of this subject for our people group. What are we doing? And as a deacon, have you considered that one of your primary roles is to help identify talents in your group and help develop the skills for those talents? The parable of the talents is not about money, it's about capacity. Think about that. The parable of talents is not about money, it's about capacity. Step one is identify what God has uniquely wired this person to do. Entrepreneurial, analytical, creative. There's a lot of other questions you could ask there. How can you affirm that person in their calling and the talents that God has given them? Let me hasten to say this. This is an insert, and you can take issue with this, but I don't believe that the terminology developing your talents is a correct English terminology. Because I believe when God gives you the talents, he gives them to you perfect. What you're lacking is the skills to execute those talents. Think about that. Number two is develop. Help that person develop the skills. So talent is potential. Help develop the skill that develops a capacity. And remember that capacity word. Financial skills are learnable. Step three, deploy. In the context of accountability, a first job, a budget, a small business, these are training grounds. When you think of part of your role, part of your responsibility is identifying talents and helping develop those skills, think of IDD, identify, develop, deploy. Identify, develop, deploy. You should forevermore be engaged in that. Next is the financial literacy ladder. And again, I have courses where I spend 2 days teaching just this slide. I have about 2 minutes to tell you what I want to tell you in this slide. And so I'm going to give you the high level of umbrella here as a tool, and I want you to go back and study into this more and ask more questions so that you have some framework of how you're teaching. See, when you get these kind of tools confused and mixed up, you don't have the right language to teach the next generation. You don't know, so they don't know, and the blindness continues. The first one is bookkeeping. Records, records. Bookkeeping records what happened. You cannot manage what you do not measure. The second one is accounting. Interpret what it means. Numbers without interpretation are noise. The third one is finance. Allocate resources over time. This is where stability is built or destroyed. And then the fourth one is business intelligence. Anticipates what is likely, separates reactive from proactive leaders. It intrigues me sometimes of how those terms get confused in our businesses or even in church work. You might have somebody that is very, very qualified and does incredibly well in bookkeeping, but I would never want them for the CFO of my organization. And maybe they're not the right person to be the deacon in your congregation just because they're good at bookkeeping. As a deacon, you need a reasonable grasp of all four of these to understand how those come together. You can be, I know of brothers that are serving as deacons that do quite well in the business intelligence or the intelligence around the financial side of things and the finance. I would never want them doing the daily bookkeeping. Maybe if you're a deacon that is struggling with bookkeeping and you can't show clear reporting, maybe ask your congregation if you can have a brother in church that is good at treasury work, at doing bookkeeping to help you, because you need to be able to report very clearly to the group what's going on. You need to be able to teach all four of these to the next generation. Why this all matters. This is not about financial success. It's about faithfulness. I want to let that land well. I want that to sink into your hearts. This is not about financial success. It's about faithfulness. Brothers, do you know that our people group and humanity in general has a much better record of being faithful under times of need and hard times than under prosperity? Let that soak in. Study Isaiah. Look at what happened to Hezekiah. In a time of need, he was faithful. He listened to what God had to say. And when Assyria came up and they were going to try to politically trick him into what they were going to do, God told him, tell your servants that go out there, meet the people from Assyria coming up, and just all I want you to do is be silent. That's all I want you to do is just be silent. They were faithful. And God said, because of your faithfulness, I will take care of you. In fact, I will send a blast. What he says, I will send it in the King James version. I will send a blast and I will take care of this. A chapter later, it says that God sent a blast and killed an army of, I forget what the number was, 300,000 people, soldiers or whatnot, just boom, took them out with one blast. What did Hezekiah do? All of a sudden, he's like, you know, I think I got this. Then Babylon came up. Who remembers what he did when Babylon came up? He brought them in and he said, hey, look at all the good things that I have. Pride and ego had set in. God, through Isaiah, came and told him, you know, you just got done showing Babylon everything that you have in your palace. Everything that you have, including your own sons, are going to be taken captive and are going to end up over there in Babylon. And to make this worse, he says, your sons are going to be eunuchs serving in that palace. No grandpahood there. I'm a grandpa, and grandpahood's underrated. I don't know about you, that'd be pretty severe to get that notice from Isaiah. What happened? He wasn't faithful. And then Isaiah comes and says, then Hezekiah gets sick. And he cries out to God again. And he says, I want some more time. God gave him 15 more years. God gave him 15 more years. I want you to write in your papers, somewhere in your notes, what am I going to do with my next 15 years? Let 15 years be a type of the rest of your life. What am I going to do with my next 15 years? God gave Hezekiah 15 more years. And then Hezekiah asked a question, and this just makes me sick to the depths of my stomach. When he asked Isaiah asked, so, hey, tell me, so I'm sick, so what's going to happen to me? And Isaiah God through Isaiah says, you know what? You're going to be okay. Isaiah says, whew, at least it's going to be fine with me. One of my closing questions is, if this group here is putting, if you're putting most of your energy into saying, into making sure that it's fine with you, then you are not thinking about what you're putting into the next generation. What you're putting into the next generation should be keeping you up awake at night. It should be a substantial portion of what you are busy with. The world needs communities that prove an alternative is possible, where money serves the people, not the other way around. Your investment in the next generation is the greatest kingdom investment that you can make. The measure of our stewardship is not what we accumulated, it's what we multiplied. Well done, good and faithful servant. You have been faithful over little, I will set you over much. Isn't that the words that every deacon would like to hear when we meet our Savior face to face? Matthew 25, 21. Thank you. This has been truly been an honor for me to be able to spend this time with you. Really looking forward to the rest of today. I realize we went over a lot of content very quickly. I have my information, my email there. If you're interested in my phone number, you can either see me afterwards or whatnot. I do have a fair bit of content that I'm willing to send out for free if people want. My heart is that God would give you wisdom, that He would give you grace to help prepare the next generation in this rebirthing process. God bless.